This is a reading from Shawshank Redemption. With two inmates, Andy Dufresne and Red, are eating in the Shawshank prison. Andy, that's the beauty of music. They can't get that from you. Haven't you ever felt that way about music? I played a mean harmonica as a younger man. Lost interest in it, though. Didn't make much sense in here. Here's where it makes the most sense. You need it so you don't forget. Forget? Forget that there are places in this world that aren't made out of stone. That there's something inside that they can't get to, that they can't touch, that's yours. What are you talking about? Hope. Let me tell you something, my friend. Hope is a dangerous thing. Hope can drive a man insane. It's got no use on the inside. You'd better get used to that idea.
Good morning. So I've been thinking a lot about hope recently. I think prompted by the recent deaths here at MIT. Well, we can never fully know or understand what was going on for Matthew or Christina. It seems to me that a person would not choose to end their own life unless they are truly feeling hopeless. But, as Red from the Shawshank Redemption points out, hope is a dangerous thing. And I wholeheartedly agree with them, that statement. And this is actually something I experienced in my time at MIT. So when I showed up to MIT as a freshman, I was filled with hope. MIT was my dream school. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life, but MIT represented limitless possibilities. And beyond just academics, I was experiencing friendships on a whole new level, finding exhilarating connections with all these amazing people. And then I entered into a long-term dating relationship, and it dwarfed my previous romantic experiences. And to my surprise, I found myself on a sports team, and for the first time in my life, was filled with hope for what my physical body could be. I was on a seemingly never-ending gravy train of hope for the first half of MIT. Then, on Reg Day, at the beginning of my junior year, I got a phone call from back home in Texas. There had been a car accident. My father had been killed. So obviously, that's a devastating piece of news for anybody to receive, and it certainly was for me. So immediately, I was on a plane to go home and be with my family. We had the funeral and time together, but pretty soon I was faced with the inevitable question, now what? Do I go back to school? Do I stay at home? What would I do with myself at home? And I had no framework for addressing questions like these. But I knew that if I was going to go back, I needed to do it soon. I had already missed over a week of school, and falling behind is never a good idea at MIT. So I decided to come back. I reasoned that my dad would not want me to miss out on my life. And I didn't want to miss out either. So the next couple of years were a blur, a constant frenzy of unceasing, frantic activity. Subconsciously, I had chosen a simple strategy for dealing with grief. Avoid it. Leave no room for it. Be so constantly busy every moment of every day that there is no mental or emotional bandwidth for grief. And it won't surprise you to know that MIT was rather accommodating to this strategy. And this strategy actually worked pretty well, at least externally. My grades went up, I was elected to be the president of my fraternity, and I was competitive in a very demanding varsity sport. But increasingly, my internal world was falling apart. By the time I graduated, I was emotionally bankrupt. All that hope that had been propelling me forward was gone. My passion for science had somehow gotten crowded out or tainted. My friendship circle was getting smaller and smaller. My dating relationship, which I was assuming was heading towards marriage, was actually heading toward ruin, thanks to my emotional toxicity. Even the sport I was doing, which I loved, had somehow become an unhealthy addiction. And I was quickly becoming very isolated. I was bubbling over with anger and bitterness, and my life felt void of purpose. In a word, I felt hopeless. So all this was the context for a very unexpected spiritual journey that I was about to embark on. And I don't have time to tell all of that story right now, but spoiler alert, it ends with me becoming a chaplain and the happy, healthy individual that you see standing here today. And hope has played and still plays a very important role in that journey. Strangely, hope was both the destination and the road that took me there, the ends and the means. So hope gets a lot of attention in the Bible. And looking back, I can see some of the Bible's insights on hope borne out in my own story in pretty striking ways. So, for instance, there's this really famous, inspiring-sounding line about hope in the New Testament. It's in a letter this guy Paul, who was an early faith entrepreneur, wrote to some faith communities in Rome. And it's printed on your sheets. But I have to warn you, it risks sounding too good to be true and feeling disconnected from reality. So this is from Romans. And let us rejoice in hope of the glory of God. And not only that, but let us rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. So I won't be able to unpack all of what's here, but I'll offer just a few comments. First, this passage confidently asserts that hope does not disappoint us. I wonder how you feel about that. Does that ring true? So I have a somewhat visceral response to this, and especially if I'm in the mindset of those first few years after losing my dad. I can feel that this has got to be a typo, because hope absolutely does disappoint us. It is, in fact, because we hope for something that we experience disappointment when we don't get it. So maybe this contradiction means we just need to dismiss these ideas altogether. But I think there's another possibility, too, which I hope you'll consider. It's a possibility that Paul is talking about something different here. This passage seems to indicate that hope is much more than a feeling, much more than the greeting card sentiment that I tend to regard it as. The hope that's described here is not particularly easy to come by. It's more rare, more valuable, more robust, and more powerful than we might expect. And it's the final product of a long and difficult process. So you can see this idea of hope being the destination, where we want to end up. But I think hope is also the path we take to get there. And it's an unexpected, maybe even a hidden path. And we get the first clue when Paul says, "Let us rejoice in our sufferings." Seriously? Who does that? And if we could pull that off, rejoicing, is the suffering really that bad? But this supremely counterintuitive act of choosing joy and gratitude in the midst of suffering, to whatever degree we can pull that off, I think will start us down the path that is hope. And we see the path starts with suffering, and then endurance, and then character, and then finally hope. And I'm not precisely sure how all these steps work. But one thing seems clear to me. This is not our typical human response to hardship. This seems to suggest somehow resisting that overwhelming temptation we all feel to avoid pain in one way or another. So maybe the endurance that's described here is not just surviving difficult, painful circumstances, but it's actually enduring the suffering, experiencing the pain that's brought on by those circumstances. Now, this is not masochism, but it is fully facing up to the suffering that's coming at us and not dodging it. So, in his most famous teaching, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." And I think he's talking about the same approach to suffering. Instead of going with our first instinct to avoid the pain, we mourn. We actually feel it. And then we'll experience comfort. But if we try to dodge it, we'll just end up in limbo, with the suffering still lurking in the shadows and no experience of comfort. So, you know, there's a YouTube clip that illustrates this point way better than I do. And I thought about showing it, but we're not really set up for that. So I'm taking this unorthodox step of putting a link on the handout that you have. And so this clip features the modern-day philosopher and sage, Louis C.K. And it's so well worth your time that I encourage you to check it out. So, mourning leads to comfort. But I think Paul is promising something even better than comfort. He says that hope does not disappoint us because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit. And I think that simply refers to an intimate experience of God's love, a deep connection. And I know that this could sound exclusive, only applying to those who believe in God, but I don't think that's the case, and I want to speak to that in just a second. So my brief 36 years on this earth has convinced me that all of life boils down to relationships, to connection. Our connection with other people, our connection to ourselves, and our connection to God, or the universe, or reality, or whatever may be out there that's bigger than us. So while our circumstances are always uncertain, always holding the potential for all kinds of pain, there's a way in which suffering is not only not a threat to that connection, but can actually enhance, strengthen, and even supercharge that connection, which is perhaps our deepest desire. And when this happens, disappointment is no longer a threat. And speaking of connection, this paradoxical response of suffering and simultaneously rejoicing, of response to suffering of simultaneously rejoicing and mourning is pretty hard to pull off by yourself. It's the sort of thing where the help of trusted friends and a higher power, if you believe in one, is really indispensable. So similarly to hope, connection is both the destination and the means to get there. But clearly, not all of us at MIT believe in God. Well, more and more, I'm coming to see that the benefits of hope and connection are not limited to those with a particular set of beliefs. So I'm very much hopeful that anyone who's so inclined can experience these dynamics. And to this end, maybe we can borrow a page from the Alcoholics Anonymous playbook. In AA, looking to a higher power for help is an essential and non-negotiable element of the 12 steps. Yet many secular folks who don't subscribe to the idea of a higher power have been immensely helped by 12-step programs. And they've been given a very generous latitude to interpret that higher power in the way that feels most true and honest to them, even if it's in a thoroughly non-theistic way. For some, it's an undefined metaphysical goodness. For others, it's simply the universe, or reality as it is. For some, it's the community offered by AA, or maybe the fellowship and goodwill of humankind. So I'm hopeful you can figure out a way that this works for you. And if you'll indulge me again, I have one more link for you to check out. This is a post from the MIT admissions blogs, where an MIT student tells her story of a very powerful experience along these lines. So inevitably, there will be painful moments ahead for all of us. I wonder if walking down the path of hope, rejoicing and mourning with whomever will join us will take us to a place of deeper hope and deeper connection than we thought possible.